On this page, you will find a collection of texts drawn from the Greek alphabetical collection of the Apophthegmata, or Sayings of the Desert Fathers and Mothers. There are several principal collections, although they overlap to a very great extent. There is a Latin systematic collection, which paradoxically seems to have been collected and recorded somewhat earlier than the final versions, even of the Greek version that we're looking at today, the alphabetical Greek collection, although, and I say paradoxical, because the Greek is undoubtedly the original language. The original sayings were undoubtedly transmitted in Greek, although many of them, of course, were made by men whose language was Coptic, whose sayings then had to be translated into Greek. But intriguingly, the collections as we have them now have been edited and re-edited in a way that allow us to date the Latin collection as being somewhat earlier. All of them date from somewhere around the early years of the 5th century, of the 400s, several decades after, in many cases, not in all, of the deaths of the individuals whose sayings are recorded. Some of the collections are probably from somewhat later in the 5th century. But the principal thing to note is that in both the Greek and the Latin versions, there is overwhelmingly a great deal of overlap. Both collections contain mostly material that is common to both. So one can, as it were, combine them, look at them, compare them, and discover that they are very careful and faithful renditions. With the exception that the slightly later editorial version that we're looking at today sometimes includes the deletion of certain names that were regarded as suspect at that time. So, for example, occasionally Evagrius's name is eliminated because by this time he had become something of a figure of controversy, as we'll discuss later in the course. The sayings, and before specifically mentioning them, I should probably describe the fact that there are some minor collections as well. There is an anonymous collection. There are versions in Syriac and in Coptic and in a couple of other languages. All of these collections bear witness to what can only be called a Christian wisdom literature, which describes the experience of spiritual direction in the desert. It describes what happened when either disciples asked their teachers to describe their way of life, or more commonly, when individuals went to these teachers, either their own disciples or other people, sometimes lay people who came to visit from the outside, who, as it were, made the rounds of some of these important teachers, and asked them the sentence, "Father or mother, give me a word." In other words, a word or a phrase to live by. And in some cases, in many cases, this simply meant a verse from the scriptures to meditate, to hold in my heart, so that I can more effectively deal with whatever temptation I'm wrestling with, or which can be for me a way of opening up an understanding of my life and how God needs to be more clearly present. But these were also occasions on which the desert father or mother was invited to try to summarize their lifestyle, their wisdom, in as few words as possible. And this is a very ancient tradition that goes back to the Jewish rabbinical approach, in which one will occasionally find rabbis asked to summarize the whole of the Torah in just a few sentences. Of course, Christ himself was asked to do this and responded positively by providing the great commandment to love God with heart, mind, soul, and strength, and then to love neighbor as self. So this tradition of trying to condense down the whole of the way of life, the Torah, the commandments, the invitation from God to live a life that is fully human, is a very traditional one, and one finds it occasionally represented. But one needs to have a certain degree of care in reading these texts, because often when there has been a specific question asked, such as, "Father or mother, help me, I'm struggling with the temptation to X," or "I'm struggling with the demon of Y," that introduction is sometimes lacking. And so you simply have the response of this person, and you have to try to work out what the context may have been yourself. That can be a bit tricky at times, and it's attested by the fact of the necessity of creating the systematic collections. Now, again, we're looking at the alphabetical collection, which is, although editorially somewhat later, does probably represent one of the earliest substrata of this literature, of this tradition. And it's very intriguing that the first one, which is attributed to St. Antony the Great, number one, and one, so I've given it here, it belongs to the, Antony is the first set, and it's the first apothegm attributed to him. It is a beautiful description of the practice of interweaving prayer and work. How for the desert mothers and fathers, and I think this is very helpful for us today, they did not regard their work as prayer until it was mixed with prayer, until it was consecrated, until it was specifically offered back to God. And so if their life was an alternating rhythm of self-offering and going back to work, and then, by the way, during their work, they would continue to meditate on a phrase from the scriptures, ponder in their heart something of the Psalms or of some other text, this would be a real way of consecrating work. And in this collection of sayings, this is regarded as one of the most fundamental ways of being in relationship with God. This is a practice that is recommended by the example of Antony as a spiritual director. So if we look at it, the context is that he was beset by the demon of Achidia. And we'll see this described again in other apothegma and in other stories. This is a vice which does not simply mean laziness, because this experience of Achidia can have either an agitated or a depressed form. If we wanted to try to describe it as fully as possible, we'd have to say it consists in the unwillingness, the profound unwillingness or distaste for or even hate for precisely the things that will make us holy. Achidia is any of the ways of avoiding the things that God intends that we should engage in for the purpose of sanctifying our lives. So achidia can either be a sluggishness that won't act, or it can be a kind of a frenzied desire to do everything instead of what we need to do. How do we focus on, how do we embrace the immediate project that lies before us? Achidia is the inability to do that, the demonic temptation to avoid that. So Antony is afflicted by this. He's attacked by many sinful thoughts, and he says, how can I be saved? And then he gets up and he sees a vision. He sees a man like himself engaging in this little rhythm that I've listed alternately as A, B, A, B, sitting at work and then getting up from work to prayer, then sitting down again, engaging in work, plaiting a rope, and then getting up again and praying. So spending a little time of work at work, and then presumably also, it's attested very, very widely, engaging in scripture meditation while working, but periodically setting aside the work to engage in this practice of self-offering. This, the text says, was an angel of the Lord sent to correct him. He heard the angel saying, do this and you will be saved. And he was filled with joy and courage. He did this and he was. And the word for salvation and for being saved is very close to the word for healing. He was saved. He was healed. It's almost the same phrase, almost the same term in Greek. So there is this interrelationship between self-offering, consecration, and manual labor that represents a real core, a real window into what was thought to be the most significant wisdom one could draw from the model and example of the desert fathers and mothers. Here you have people who understand the need for prayer interspersed with work in a way that the work itself becomes consecrated, becomes offered up to God. And that in turn makes the work possible, makes it less hateful, makes it less subject to this distraction of achidia. If we drop down a bit, in number 1-2, we hear this beautiful focusing kind of phrase, the conclusion. Antony is asking all of these questions about theodicy. Why do all these terrible things happen? And the voice says to him, Antony, keep your attention on yourself. Pros eche seauto. Antony is to pay attention, to take heed for, be focused on his own unique circumstances. In the Chronicles of Narnia, C.S. Lewis liked to say this by explaining to the reader, Aslan doesn't tell anybody's story other than their own. We are only told our own story. We may be of benefit to another person in uncovering their story, but the deeper meaning of things is revealed within the context of our own struggle. And the question about, you know, how do I discern the meaning in somebody else's struggle is often a way of distracting us from the primary task of finding God in the actual events with which we're working. If we drop down then to number 1-3, What should I do to please God? Here you have an attempt to condense down a monastic way of life into three little different foci. Whoever you may be, have God before your eyes. Rather like this previous statement, keeping your attention focused on yourself. Number two, whatever you do, do it according to the testimony of the Holy Scriptures. So bear in mind what the Scriptures say. It's not just about having a deep spirituality in some sort of generic sense. It's about having a relationship with God that is measured by, informed by, and is even judged by the text of the Scriptures itself. One goes back to the Bible all the time in this model. And in whatever place you live, do not easily leave it. Stay where you are. This idea of a stability that will teach one comes up later, and we'll see it in some of the other fathers, the idea that your cell will teach you everything. In number 1.5, the very beautiful observation, which again we'll see in slightly different contexts, without temptations, no one can be saved. Without the testing of our faith, without the maturity that comes from having reflected on the possibility of choosing either good or evil, and discovering that it means a deepening relationship with God to choose the good, all of this, of course, as a gift of grace, without that, there is no deepening in faith. There is no spiritual maturity. Rather, baldly, one might even say, crassly said here, there is no salvation, which, of course, is not technically true, but it's a very strong way of putting the importance of wrestling with and understanding the significance of temptations. And we'll have to move now rather quickly through this, the rest of this text, in order to try to draw out a couple of themes from these apothegmata, and I would invite you to go back and spend a little time reflecting on them on your own. Number 1.8, he says, there may be those who have afflicted their bodies by asceticism, by ascesis, by spiritual exercise, but if they lack discernment, they are far from God. This virtue of diakrisis, or discretio in the Latin, discernment, which we'll be looking at in more detail. This was a prized virtue, and it meant the capacity to choose the right thing when confronted with choices concerning one's spiritual life. How do I distinguish, as we'll see Antony inviting us to do, how do I distinguish between the demonic and the angelic? How do I distinguish between the good choices and the problematic choices? In the much later tradition, this will become, as a part of the Ignatian exercises of the Ignatian tradition, a whole way of approaching the question of Christian decision-making, the discernment of thoughts, of choices, of life options. So he then says in number 1.9, this is very valuable, because remember that Antony was living as a hermit, was revered as a hermit, our life and our death is with our neighbor. If we gain our brother, we've gained God. If we scandalize our brother, we have sinned against Christ. So it is in the context of interpersonal relationship that the issue of life and death is worked out, even for those who live in a semi-solitary context. Number 1.17, there's a beautiful record of Antony praising one of the fathers who says he doesn't know what a text of the Scriptures means. That to recognize one's own ignorance and one's need for further growth is absolutely essential and represents a very high attainment of wisdom. In number 1.24, Antony was revealed to him that there was someone who was his equal in the city, and it turns out to have been a physician, a doctor, not a holy ascetic living by themselves and praying in silence or quietude within the city, but someone who's actively engaged in the work that God gives him, in this case, giving to the poor, and it is said rather beautifully, every day he sang the Sanctus, the Tris Agion, with the angels, that his prayer was ascending with that of the angels. So it's possible to live the kind of life that Antony lives in the world, and we'll see this coming out again in later apothegmata. We've already seen, at number 134, the story of the foundation of Kelia, reflecting this interaction between Amun, who founds these semi-cenobitic communities in Nitria, and Antony, a beautiful external reminder of the interaction between the hermit and the semi-communal ways of life, and another lovely reminder in 135 of the necessity to focus on the task that we have at hand spiritually. We need to make up our minds what kind of virtue we are supposed to be forging. It's not just a question of meeting the troubles of the day. It's a question of having a plan, being aware of what it is within ourselves needs to change. In a 12-step context, this would be called working one's program, knowing the addiction or the weakness which particularly tends to beset me and which virtue I therefore need to work on. In the case of Abba Arsenius, who's the next desert father we encounter, Arsenius was a renowned hermit. He very much wanted to get away from people living in the world. He had spent his life in public service and had been a very wealthy individual. And so he hears and follows the advice, number 2.1, flee from men and you will be saved. And so his wisdom in 2.2 consists in having heard a voice that said, flee, be silent, be tranquil. Fuge, siopa, hesukadze. So leave the context of busyness, of involvement with others, be silent, that is to say, do not speak, external silence, and be hezukadze, tranquil within, that is to say, a kind of an inner quiet is to be attained or is to be achieved as well. So this is his threefold method, his threefold way of life. And he goes on to say in number 2.3 that he acknowledges all the time that he's only just making a beginning. And we'll see this is a very important notion for St. Antony in his great homily in the Athanasius depiction of the life of Antony as well. So if we look then at number 2.5, Arsenius, who was not only previously wealthy but is very well educated, is visited by someone whom we know was Evagrius because of the Latin version, but which the Greek has edited out because of its suspicion of Evagrius. Evagrius says, how is it that we, with all of our education and our knowledge, get nowhere, while these rustic Egyptians, these Egyptian peasants, acquire so many virtues? And Arsenius says, we get nothing from our secular education, but these Egyptian peasants acquire their virtues by hard work, by reflecting on their tasks, by engaging on asceticism, looking at that, asking the meaning of it. There's a kind of a daily ongoing recommitment to the project of seeking virtue that represents something higher than intellectual attainment. And this becomes known in number 2.6 as the alphabet of these holy monks. He calls it the alphabet of this rustic Copt, this Egyptian peasant. I've been taught Latin and Greek, but I'm just learning. I don't even know the alphabet of this holy peasant. This is the notion of an inward reading, a kind of a lectio of thoughts and of the significance of behavior and action, which we'll see much more concretely and specifically and systematically arranged by Evagrius. We are to engage in a learning to read the inner landscape of our own hearts. And that's an alphabet we can only learn through ascetical practice. And intriguingly, in number 2.7, he's visited by the archbishop, accompanied by a magistrate. And he's frustrated, of course, because he wants to be left alone. They ask him for a word, and he says, will you do what I tell you? And they say, oh, yes, we will. And his response is, if you hear that Arsenius is somewhere, don't go there. In other words, please leave and don't come back. So Arsenius had a very strong reputation for wanting to be left alone, and people sometimes found themselves experiencing what they thought was being insulted because of this desire to be left in solitude. So if we drop down now to Macarius the Great, one of the great heroes of this literature, together with Pambo and Antony, he, in number 3.19, offers a kind of advice that involves the use of short phrase monologistic prayer. How should we pray? And he says, you don't need to make long prayers. It's enough to stretch out your hands and say, Lord, as you will and as you know, have mercy. Kyrie hos theles, kai hos oidos eleison. Very short, very brief prayer. Or he says, you can even make it briefer if your struggle is worse. Kyrie boethe, Lord, help. So this tradition develops rather significantly in Cassian. In the East, of course, it's the basis for the Jesus prayer. In the West, it's the basis for what comes to be known as ejaculatory prayer, the use of short phrase or short aspiration prayers. And it remains a very important tradition in East and West today. If we drop down now to number 4, to Abba Moses, There are a number of collections here, one of the most significant, 4:6, where Moses says, "Go sit in your cell will teach you everything. In solitude, your way of life will itself become a way of discerning this alphabet of the heart." Now bear in mind, of course, that it wasn't just in solitude. They were also in relationship with the spiritual Abba, and even if they were an Abba themselves, they would often visit or be visited by others and share their thoughts and their issues with one another. If we drop down to numbers 4, 14, and 1 through 7, this is a list, an attempt to systematize Abba Moses's own way of life. Ideas like you must never judge, a very important theme throughout this literature, that our deeds must be in harmony with prayer, we shouldn't do the things that are against our prayer, and so on. And again, I would leave you to look at this at your leisure. Amma Theodora, if you drop down to number 5, and Amma Sarah in 6, Amma Syncletica in number 7, these are famous women, famous mothers of the desert. They too left behind a smaller body, but a significant body of literature, and I've chosen some of the texts from these great teachers. Number 7:13, the necessity to hate the sickness but never the sick person, always love one who is afflicted and who is seeking spiritual guidance, but to be clear that the sin itself is something to be avoided and never to be countenanced. She also talks in number 7:15 about the need for balance and proportion. And then number 7:19, Amma Syncletica says that it's possible, just as it's possible to be a solitary in one's mind while living in a crowd, so you don't have to leave society in order to practice the way of the desert, must also be a solitary even in the crowd of your own thoughts. Even within the inner struggle, you must nevertheless be aware of the necessity to constantly be focused on the fact of your own inner journey and your own inner movement forward. And I'll again leave you to take a look at this as you like, to spend a little time on this material. And again, bear in mind that there was no sense that this was to be read sequentially. One could pick up one apothem or another and simply read them, allow them to touch the heart, and then evoke a kind of a response. That was the reason for this literature, and it's one of the uses which it has always traditionally continued to have.